Jamie. The fields outside the walls of Derry were being tilled once more. The burned crops had been ploughed under, and Sir Adam's scouts reported seeing women in the furrows pulling weeds, whilst a team of oxen broke new ground on the edge of a nearby wood. A dozen bearded men with axes stood guard over them as they worked. By the time Jamie and his column reached the castle, all of them had fled within the walls. He found Derry closed to him, just as Harrenhal had been. "A chilly welcome from mine own blood." "Sound the horn," he commanded. Sir Kenos of Case unslung the horn of Herrick and let it wind. As he waited for a response from the castle, Jamie eyed the banner floating brown and crimson above his cousin's barbican. Lancel had taken to quartering the Lion of Lannister with the Derry ploughman, it would seem. He saw his uncle's hand in that, as in Lancel's choice of bride. House Derry had ruled these lands since the Andals cast down the first men. No doubt Sir Kevin realized that his son would have an easier time of it if the peasants saw him as a continuation of the old line, holding these lands by right of marriage rather than royal decree. "Kevin should be Tommen's hand. Harry's swift is a toad, and my sister is a fool if she thinks elsewise." The castle gates swung open slowly. "My cuz will not have room to accommodate 1,000 men," Jamie told Strongmore. "We'll make camp beneath the western wall. I want the perimeters ditched and staked. There are still bands of outlaws in these parts."
"They'd need to be mad to attack a force as strong as ours."
"Mad or starving?" Until he had a better notion of these outlaws and their strength, Jamie was not inclined to take any risks with his defences. "Ditched and staked," he said again before spurring Honor toward the gate. Sir Dermot rode beside him with the royal stag and lion, and Sir Hugo Vance with the white standard of the Kingsguard. Jamie had charged Red Ronnet with the task of delivering Willis Manderley to Maidenpool, so he would not need to look on him henceforth. Pia rode with Jamie's squires on the gelding Peck had found for her.
"It's like some toy castle," Jamie heard her say. "She's known no home but Harrenhal," he reflected. "Every castle in the realm will seem small to her, except the rock."
Josmyn Peckleton was saying the same thing.
"You must not judge by Harrenhal. Black Harren built too big."
Pia listened as solemnly as a girl of 5 being lessoned by her scepter. "That's all she is. A little girl in a woman's body scarred and scared." Peck was taken with her, though. Jamie suspected that the boy had never known a woman, and Pia was still pretty enough so long as she kept her mouth closed. There's no harm in him bedding her, I suppose, so long as she's willing. One of the mountain's men had tried to rape the girl at Harrenhal, and had seemed honestly perplexed when Jamie commanded Illyn Payne to take his head off.
"I had her before 100 times, he kept saying, as they forced him to his knees. 100 times, my lord. We all had her."
When Sir Illyn presented Pia with his head, she had smiled through her ruined teeth. Derry had changed hands several times during the fighting, and its castle had been burned once and sacked at least twice, but Lancel had seemingly wasted little time setting things to rights. The castle gates were newly hung, raw oaken planks reinforced with iron studs. A new stable was going up where an older one had been put to the torch. The steps to the keep had been replaced, and the shutters on many of the windows. Blackened stones showed where the flames had licked, but time and rain would fade those. Within the walls, crossbowmen walked the ramparts, some in crimson cloaks and lion-crested helms, others in the blue and grey of House Frey. As Jamie trotted across the yard, chickens ran out from under Honor's hooves, sheep bleated, and peasants stared at him with sullen eyes. Armed peasants, he did not fail to note. Some had scythes, some staves, some a hose sharpened to cruel points. There were axes in evidence as well, and he spied several bearded men with red 7-pointed stars sewn onto ragged, filthy tunics.
More bloody sparrows. Where do they all come from?
Of his uncle Kevin he saw no sign, nor of Lancel.
Only a maester emerged to greet him with a grey robe flapping about his skinny legs.
Lord Commander, Dari is honoured by this unexpected visit. You must forgive our lack of preparations. We had been given to understand that you were bound for Riverrun.
Dari was on my way, lied Jamie. Riverrun will keep. And if perchance the siege had ended before he reached the castle, he would be spared the need to take up arms against House Tully. Dismounting, he handed honor to a stable boy. Will I find my uncle here? He did not supply a name. Sir Kevin was the only uncle he had left, the last surviving son of Tytus Lannister.
No, my lord. Sir Kevin took his leave of us after the wedding.
The maester pulled at the chain collar, as if it had grown too tight for him.
I know Lord Lancel will be pleased to see you and all your gallant knights, though it pains me to confess that Dari cannot feed so many.
We have our own provisions.
You are Maester Ottermore, if it please my lord. Lady Amaray wished to welcome you herself, but she is seeing to the preparation of a feast in your honour. It is her hope that you and your chief knights and captains will join us at table this evening.
A hot meal would be most welcome. The days have been cold and wet. Jamie glanced about the yard at the bearded faces of the sparrows. Too many, and too many frays as well. Where will I find Hardstone?
We had a report of outlaws beyond the Trident. Sir Harwin took 5 knights and 20 archers and went to deal with them.
And Lord Lancel?
He is at his prayers. His lordship has commanded us never to disturb him when he is praying.
He and Sir Bonifer should get on well. Very well. There would be time enough to talk with his cousin later. Show me to my chambers and have a bath brought up.
If it please my lord, we have put you in the ploughman's keep. I will show you there.
I know the way. Jamie was no stranger to this castle. He and Circe had been guests here twice before, once on their way to Winterfell with Robert, and again on the way back to King's Landing. Though small as castles went, it was larger than an inn with good hunting along the river. Robert Baratheon had never been loath to impose upon the hospitality of his subjects. The keep was much as he recalled it. The walls are still bare, Jamie observed as the maester led him down a gallery.
Lord Lancel hopes one day to cover them with hangings, said Ottermore, scenes of piety and devotion.
Piety and devotion. It was all he could do not to laugh. The walls had been bare on his first visit, too. Tyrion had pointed out the squares of darker stone where tapestries had once hung. Sir Raymond could remove the hangings, but not the marks they'd left. Later, the imp had slipped a handful of stags to one of Dari's serving men for the key to the cellar where the missing tapestries were hidden. He showed them to Jaime by the light of a candle, grinning. Woven portraits of all the Targaryen kings, from the first Aegon to the second Ennys.
If I tell Robert, mayhaps he'll make me Lord of Dari, the dwarf said, chortling.
Maester Ottermore led Jaime to the top of the keep.
I trust you will be comfortable here, my lord. There is a privy when nature calls. Your window looks out upon the godswood. The bedchamber adjoins her ladyship's, with a servant's cell between.
These were Lord Dari's own apartments.
Yes, my lord.
My cousin is too kind. I did not intend to put Lancel out of his own bedchamber.
Lord Lancel has been sleeping in the sept.
Sleeping with the mother and the maiden when he has a warm wife just through that door? Jamie did not know whether to laugh or weep. Maybe he is praying for his cock to harden. In King's Landing it had been rumored that Lancel's wounds had left him incapable. Still, he ought to have sense enough to try. His cousin's hold on his new lands would not be secure until he fathered a son on his half-Dari wife. Jamie had begun to rue the impulse that had brought him here. He gave thanks to Ottermore, reminded him about the bath, and had Peck see him out. The lord's bedchamber had changed since his last visit, and not for the better. Old stale rushes covered the floor in place of the fine mirrorish carpet that had been there previously, and all the furnishings were new and crudely made. Sir Raymond Daddy's bed had been large enough to sleep six, with brown velvet draperies and oakwood posts carved with vines and leaves. Lancel's was a lumpy straw pallet placed beneath the window where the first light of day would be sure to wake him. The other bed had no doubt been burned or smashed or stolen, but even so.
When the tub arrived, little Lou pulled off Jamie's boots and helped remove his golden hand. Peck and Garrett hauled water, and Pia found him something clean to sup in. The girl glanced at him shyly as she shook his doublet out. Jamie was uncomfortably aware of the curve of hip and breast beneath her rough-spun brown dress. He found himself remembering the things that Pia had whispered to him at Harrenhal, the night that Qyburn sent her to his bed.
"Sometimes when I'm with some man," she'd said, "I close my eyes and pretend it's you on top of me."
He was grateful when the bath was deep enough to conceal his arousal. As he lowered himself into the steaming water, he recalled another bath, the one he'd shared with Brian. He had been feverish and weak from loss of blood, and the heat had made him so dizzy he found himself saying things better left unsaid. This time he had no such excuse. "Remember your vows. Pia is more fit for Tyrion's bed than yours. Fetch me soap and a stiff brush," he told Peck. "Pia, you may leave us."
"Aye, my lord. Thank you, my lord."
She covered her mouth when she spoke to hide her broken teeth. "Do you want her?" Jamie asked Peck when she was gone. The squire turned beet red. "If she'll have you, take her. She'll teach you a few things you'll find useful on your wedding night, I don't doubt. And you're not like to get a bastard by her." Pia had spread her legs for half his father's army and never quickened. Most like, the girl was barren. "If you bed her, though, be kind to her."
"Kind, my lord? How would I—"
"Sweet words. Gentle touches. You don't want to wed her, but so long as you're abed, treat her as you would your bride." The lad nodded.
"My lord, where should I take her? There's never a place to
be alone." Jamie grinned. "We'll be at supper several hours. The straw looks lumpy, but it should serve." Peck's eyes grew wide.
"His lordship's bed.
You'll feel a lord yourself when you're done, if Pia knows her business. And someone ought to make some use of that miserable straw mattress." When he descended for the feast that night, Jamie Lannister wore a doublet of red velvet slashed with cloth of gold, and a golden chain studded with black diamonds. He had strapped on his golden hand as well, polished to a fine, bright sheen. This was no fit place to wear his whites. His duty awaited him at Riverrun. A darker need had brought him here. Dary's great hall was great only by courtesy. Trestle tables crowded it from wall to wall, and the ceiling rafters were black with smoke. Jamie had been seated on the dais to the right of Lancel's empty chair.
"Will my cousin not be joining us for supper?" he asked as he sat down.
"My lord prefers to fast," said Lancel's wife, the Lady Amere. "He's sick with grief for the poor High Septon."
She was a long-legged, full-breasted, strapping girl of some 8 and 10 years, a healthy wench to look at her, though her pinched, chinless face reminded Jamie of his late and unlamented cousin Cleos, who had always looked somewhat like a weasel.
"Fasting? He is an even bigger fool than I suspected.
His cousin should be busy fathering a little weasel-faced heir on his widow, instead of starving himself to death." He wondered what Sir Kevin might have had to say about his son's new fervor. Could that be the reason for his uncle's abrupt departure? Over bowls of bean and bacon soup, Lady Amory told Jamie how her first husband had been slain by Sir Gregor Clegane when the Freys were still fighting for Robb Stark.
"I begged him not to go, but my pate was oh so very brave, and swore he was the man to slay that monster. He wanted to make a great name for himself."
"We all do."
"When I was a squire, I told myself I'd be the man to slay the Smiling Knight."
"The Smiling Knight?"
She sounded lost.
"Who was that?"
"The mountain of my boyhood, half as big but twice as mad.
An outlaw, long dead,
No one who need concern your ladyship. Amory's lip trembled. Tears rolled from her brown eyes.
You must forgive my daughter, said an older woman.
Lady Amory had brought a score of Freys to Derry with her, a sister, an uncle, a half-uncle, various cousins, and her mother, who had been born a Derry.
She still grieves for her father.
Outlaws killed him, sobbed Lady Amory.
Father had only gone out to ransom Peter Pimple. He brought them the gold they asked for, but they hung him anyway.
Hanged, Army? Your father was not a tapestry.
Lady Maria turned back to Jamie.
I believe you knew him, sir.
We were squires together once at Craig Hall. He would not go so far as to claim they had been friends. When Jamie had arrived, Merritt Frey had been the castle bully, lording it over all the younger boys. Then he tried to bully me.
He was very strong.
It was the only praise that came to mind. Merritt had been slow and clumsy and stupid, but he was strong.
You fought against the Kingswood Brotherhood together, sniffed Lady Amory. Father used to tell me stories.
Father used to boast and lie, you mean.
We did.
Frey's chief contributions to the fight had consisted of contracting the pox from a camp follower and getting himself captured by the White Fawn. The outlaw queen burned her sigil into his arse before ransoming him back to Sumner Craighall. Merritt had not been able to sit down for a fortnight, though Jamie doubted that the red-hot iron was half so nasty as the kettles of shit his fellow squires made him eat once he was returned. Boys are the cruelest creatures on the earth. He slipped his golden hand around his wine cup and raised it up. To Merritt's memory, he said, it was easier to drink to the man than to talk of him. After the toast, Lady Amory stopped weeping and the table talk turned to wolves of the four-footed kind. Sir Danwell Frey claimed there were more of them about than even his grandfather could remember.
They've lost all fear of men.
Packs of them attacked our baggage train on our way down from the Twins. Our archers had to feather a dozen before the others fled. Sir Adam Marbrand confessed that their own column had faced similar troubles on their way up from King's Landing. Jamie concentrated on the fare before him, tearing off chunks of bread with his left hand and fumbling at his wine cup with his right. He watched Adam Marbrand charm the girl beside him, watched Stephen Swift refight the battle for King's Landing with bread and nuts and carrots. Sir Kenneth pulled the serving girl into his lap, urging her to stroke his horn, whilst Sir Dermot regaled some squires with tales of knight-errantry in the Rainwood. Farther down the table, Hugo Vance had closed his eyes. Brooding on the mysteries of life, thought Jamie. That or napping between courses? He turned back to Lady Maria. The outlaws who killed your husband. Was it Lord Berwick's band?
So we thought at first.
Though Lady Maria's hair was streaked with grey, she was still a handsome woman.
The killers scattered when they left Old Stones. Lord Viperin tracked one band to Fairmarket, but lost them there. Black Walder led hounds and hunters into Hag's Mire after the others. The peasants denied seeing them, but when questioned sharply, they sang a different song. They spoke of a one-eyed man and another who wore a yellow cloak, and a woman, cloaked and hooded.
A woman? He would have thought that the White Fawn would have taught Merritt to stay clear of outlaw wenches. There was a woman in the Kingswood Brotherhood as well.
I know of her.
How not, her tone suggested, when she left her mark upon my husband.
The White Fawn was young and fair, they say. This hooded woman is neither.
The peasants would have us believe that her face was torn and scarred, and her eyes terrible to look upon. They claim she led the outlaws.
Led them?
Jamie found that hard to believe.
Beric Dondarrion and the Red Priest were not seen.
Lady Maria sounded certain.
Dondarrion's dead, said Strongbore. The mountain drove a knife through his eye. We have men with us who saw it.
That's one tale, said Adam Marbrand. Others will tell you that Lord Beric can't be killed. Sir Harwin
says those tales are lies.
Lady Amare wound a braid around her finger.
He has promised me Lord Beric's head. He's very gallant.
She was blushing beneath her tears. Jamie thought back on the head he'd given to Pierre. He could almost hear his little brother chuckle. Whatever became of giving women flowers? Tyrion might have asked. He would have had a few choice words for Harwin Plum as well, though gallant would not have been one of them. Plum's brothers were big, fleshy fellows with thick necks and red faces, loud and lusty, quick to laugh, quick to anger, quick to forgive. Harwin was a different sort of Plum, hard-eyed and taciturn, unforgiving, and deadly with his hammer in his hand. A good man to command a garrison, but not a man to love. Although... Jamie gazed at Lady Amare. The serving men were bringing out the fish course, a river pike baked in a crust of herbs and crushed nuts. Lancel's lady tasted it, approved, and commanded that the first portion be served to Jamie. As they set the fish before him, she leaned across her husband's place to touch his golden hand.
"You could kill Lord Beric, Sir Jamie. You slew the Smiley Knight. Please, my lord, I beg you, stay and help us with Lord Beric and the hound."
Her pale fingers caressed his golden ones. Does she think that I can feel that? The sword of the morning slew the smiling knight, my lady. Sir Arthur Dane, a better knight than me. Jamie pulled back his golden fingers and turned once more to Lady Maria. How far did Black Walder track this hooded woman and her men?
His hounds picked up their scent again north of Hag's Mire, the older woman told him. He swears that he was no more than half a day behind them when they vanished into the Neck.
"Let them rot there," declared Sir Kenneth cheerfully. "If the gods are good, they'll be swallowed up in quicksand or gobbled down by lizard lions."
"Or taken in by frog-eaters," said Sir Danwell Frey. "I would not put it past the Crannog men to shelter outlaws."
"Would that it were only them," said Lady Maria. "Some of the River Lords are hand in glove with Lord Beric's men as well."
"The small folk, too," sniffed her daughter. "Sir Harwin says they hide them and feed them, and when he asks where they've gone, they lie. They lie to their own lords."
"Have their tongues out," urged Strongbow.
"Good luck getting answers then," said Jamie. "If you want their help, you need to make them love you. That was how Arthur Dane did it when we rode against the Kingswood Brotherhood. He paid the small folk for the food we ate, brought their grievances to King Ares, expanded the grazing lands around their villages, even won them the right to fell a certain number of trees each year and take a few of the king's deer during the autumn. The forest folk had looked to Toyne to defend them, but Sir Arthur did more for them than the Brotherhood could ever hope to do and won them to our side. After that, the rest was easy."
"The Lord Commander speaks wisely," said Lady Maria. "We shall never be rid of these outlaws until the small folk come to love Lancel as much as they once loved my father and grandfather."
Jamie glanced at his cousin's empty place. "Lancel will never win their love by praying, though."
Lady Amare put on a pout. "Sir Jamie, I pray you, do not abandon us. My lord has need of you, and so do I. These are such fearful times. Some nights I can hardly sleep for fear."
"My place is with the king, my lady."
"I'll come," offered Strongbow. "Once we're done at Riverrun, I'll be itching for another fight. Not that Beric Dondarrion is like to give me one. I recall the man from Tourney's past. A comely lad in a pretty cloak he was, slight and callow."
"That was before he died,"
said young Sir Arwood Frey.
"Death changed him, the small folk say. You can kill him, but he won't stay dead. How do you fight a man like that?
And there's the hound as well. He slew 20 men at Saltpans."
Strongbow guffawed.
20 fat innkeeps, maybe. 20 serving men pissing in their breeches. 20 begging brothers armed with bowls. Not 20 knights. Not me."
"There is a knight at Saltpans," Sir Arwood insisted. "He hid behind his walls, whilst Clegane and his mad dogs ravaged through his town. You have not seen the things he did, sir."
"I have. When the reports reached the twins, I rode down with Harry's Hay and his brother Donal and half 100 men, archers,
and men-at-arms. We thought it was Lord Berwick's work and hoped to find his trail. All that remains of Saltpans is the castle, and old Sir Quincy so frightened he would not open his gates, but shouted down at us from his battlements. The rest is bones and ashes. A whole town. The hound put the buildings to the torch, and the people to the sword, and rode off laughing. The women. You would not believe what he did to some of the women. I will not speak of it at table. It made me sick to see. I cried when I heard, said Lady Amory. Jamie sipped his wine. What makes you certain it was the hound? What they were describing sounded more like Gregor's work than Sandor's. Sandor had been hard and brutal, yes, but it was his big brother who was the real monster in House Clegane. He was seen, Sir Arwood said. That helm of his is not easily mistaken nor forgotten, and there were a few who survived to tell the tale. The girl he raped, some boys who hid, a woman we found trapped beneath a blackened beam, the fisherfolk who watched the butchery from their boats. Do not call it butchery, Lady Maria said softly. That gives insult to honest butchers everywhere. Saltpans was the work of some fell beast in human skin. This is a time for beasts, Jamie reflected, for lions and wolves and angry dogs, for ravens and carrion crows. Evil work, Strongbore filled his cup again. Lady Maria, Lady Amory, your distress has moved me. You have my word. Once River Run has fallen, I shall return to hunt down the hound and kill him for you. Dogs do not frighten me. This one should. Both men were large and powerful, but Sandor Clegane was much quicker and fought with a savagery that Lyle Crakehall could not hope to match. Lady Amory was thrilled, however. You are a true knight, Sir Lyle, to help a lady in distress. At least she did not call herself a maiden. Jamie reached for his cup and knocked it over. The linen tablecloth drank the wine. As the red stain spread, his companions all pretended not to notice. High table courtesy, he told himself, but it tasted just like pity. He rose abruptly. My lady, pray excuse me. Lady Amory looked stricken. Would you leave us? There's venison to come, and capon stuffed with leeks and mushrooms. Very fine, no doubt, but I could not eat another bite. I need to see my cousin. Bowing, Jamie left them to their food. Men were eating in the yard as well. The sparrows had gathered round a dozen cook fires to warm their hands against the chill of dusk and watch fat sausages spit and sizzle above the flames. There had to be 100 of them. Useless mouths. Jamie wondered how many sausages his cousin had laid by and how he intended to feed the sparrows once they were gone. They will be eating rats by winter unless they can get a harvest in. This late in autumn, the chances of another harvest were not good. He found the sept off the castle's inner ward, a windowless, seven-sided, half-timbered building with carved wood doors and a tiled roof. Three sparrows sat upon its steps. When Jamie approached, they rose. "Where you going, my lord?" asked one. He was the smallest of the three, but he had the biggest beard. "Inside. His lordship's in there praying. His lordship is my cousin." "Well then, my lord," said a different sparrow, a huge bald man with a seven-pointed star painted over one eye. "You won't want to bother your cousin at his prayers."
"Lord Lancel is asking the Father above for guidance," said the third sparrow, the beardless one. A boy, Jamie had thought, but her voice marked her for a woman dressed in shapeless rags and a shirt of rusted mail. "He is praying for the soul of the High Septon and all the others who have died."
"They'll still be dead tomorrow," Jamie told her. "The Father above has more time than I do. Do you know who I am?"
"Some lord," said the big man with the starry eye.
"Some cripple," said the small one with the big beard.
"The Kingslayer," said the woman. "But we're no kings, just poor fellows, and you can't go in unless his lordship says you can." She hefted a spiked club, and the small man raised an axe. The doors behind them opened. "Let my cousin pass in peace, friends," Lancel said softly. "I have been expecting him."
The sparrows moved aside. Lancel looked even thinner than he had at King's Landing. He was barefoot and dressed in a plain rough-spun tunic of undyed wool that made him look more like a beggar than a lord. The crown of his head had been shaved smooth, but his beard had grown out a little. To call it peach fuzz would have given insult to the peach. It went queerly with the white hair around his ears. "Cousin," said Jamie, when they were alone within the sept, "have you lost your bloody wits?"
"I prefer to say, I've found my faith."
"Where is your father?"
"Gone. We quarreled."
Lancel knelt before the altar of his other father. "Will you pray with me, Jamie?"
"If I pray nicely, will the father give me a new hand?"
"No, but the warrior will give you courage, the smith will lend you strength, and the crone will give you wisdom." "It's a hand I need." The seven gods loomed above carved altars, the dark wood gleaming in the candlelight. A faint smell of incense hung in the air. "You sleep down here?"
"Each night I make my bed beneath a different altar, and the seven send me visions."
Balor the Blessed once had visions too, especially when he was fasting. "How long has it been since you've eaten?"
"My faith is all the nourishment I need."
"Faith is like porridge, better with milk and honey."
"I dreamed that you would come. In the dream you knew what I had done, how I'd sinned. You killed me for it."
"You're more like to kill yourself with all this fasting. Didn't Balor the Blessed fast himself onto a bier?"
"Our lives are candle flames," says the seven-pointed star. "Any errant puff of wind can snuff us out. Death is never far in this world, and seven hells await sinners who do not repent their sins. Pray with me, Jamie."
"If I do, will you eat a bowl of porridge?" When his cuz did not answer, Jamie sighed. "You should be sleeping with your wife, not with the maid. You need a son with Dari blood if you want to keep this castle."
"A pile of cold stones. I never asked for it. I never wanted it. I only wanted—"
Lancel shuddered. "Seven save me, but I wanted to be you." Jamie had to laugh. "Better me than blessed Balor. Dari needs a lion, cuz. So does your little Frey. She gets moist between the legs every time someone mentions hard stone. If she hasn't bedded him yet, she will soon."
"If she loves him, I wish them joy of one another."
"A lion shouldn't have horns. You took the girl to wife."
"I said some words and gave her a red cloak, but only to please father. Marriage requires consummation.
King Balor was made to wed his sister Dana, but they never lived as man and wife, and he put her aside as soon as he was crowned." "The realm would have been better served if he had closed his eyes and fucked her. I know enough history to know that. In any case, you're not like to be taken for Balor the Blessed."
"No,"
Lancel allowed. "He was a rare spirit, pure and brave and innocent, untouched by all the evils of the world. I am a sinner with much and more to atone for." Jamie put his hand on his cousin's shoulder. "What do you know of sin, cuz?"
"I killed my king."
"The brave man slays with a sword, the craven with a wineskin. We are both kingslayers, sir. Robert was no true king. Some might even say that a stag is a lion's natural prey." Jamie could feel the bones beneath his cousin's skin, and something else as well. Lancel was wearing a hair shirt underneath his tunic. "What else did you do to require so much atonement? Tell me." His cousin bowed his head, tears running down his cheeks. Those tears were all the answer Jamie needed. "You killed the king," he said. "Then you fucked the queen."
"I never—"
"Lay with my sweet sister. Say it. Say it."
"Never spilled my seed in her."
"Cunt," suggested Jamie.
"Womb,"
Lancel finished. "It is not treason unless you finish inside. I gave her comfort after the king died. You were a captive, your father was in the field, and your brother— she was afraid of him, and with good reason. He made me betray her."
"Did he?"
Lancel and Sir Osmond, and how many more? Was the part about Moonboy just a jibe?
Did you force her?
No! I loved her. I wanted to protect her. You wanted to be me. His phantom fingers itched. The day his sister had come to White Sword Tower to beg him to renounce his vows, she had laughed after he refused her and boasted of having lied to him 1,000 times. Jamie had taken that for a clumsy attempt to hurt him, as he'd hurt her. It may have been the only true thing that she ever said to me.
"Do not think ill of the Queen," Lancel pleaded. "All flesh is weak, Jamie. No harm came of our sin. No bastard."
"No. Bastards are seldom made upon the belly." He wondered what his cousin would say if he were to confess his own sins, the 3 treasons Circe had named Joffrey, Tommen, and Myrcella. "I was angry with Her Grace after the battle, but the High Septon said I must forgive her."
"You confessed your sins to His High Holiness, did you?"
"He prayed for me when I was wounded. He was a good man." "He's a dead man. They rang the bells for him." He wondered if his cousin had any notion what fruit his words had borne.
"Lancel, you're a bloody fool."
"You are not wrong," said Lancel, "but my folly is behind me, sir. I have asked the Father above to show me the way, and he has. I am renouncing this lordship and this wife. Hardstone is welcome to the both of them, if he likes. On the morrow I will return to King's Landing and swear my sword to the new High Septon and the 7. I mean to take vows and join the Warrior's Sons." The boy was not making sense. The Warrior's Sons were proscribed 300 years ago. The new High Septon has revived them. He sent out a call for worthy knights to pledge their lives and swords to the service of the 7. The poor fellows are to be restored as well. Why would the Iron Throne allow that? One of the early Targaryen kings had fought for years to suppress the 2 military orders, Jaime recalled, though he did not remember which, Maegor, perhaps, or the first Jaehaerys. Tyrion would have known. "His High Holiness writes that King Tommen has given his consent. I will show you the letter if you like."
"Even if this is true, you are a Lion of the Rock, a lord. You have a wife, a castle, lands to defend, people to protect. If the gods are good, you will have sons of your blood to follow you. Why would you throw all that away for some vow?"
"Why did you?" asked Lancel softly. "For honor," Jamie might have said. "For glory." That would have been a lie, though. Honor and glory had played their parts, but most of it had been for Circe. A laugh escaped his lips. "Is it the High Septon you're running to, or my sweet sister? Pray on that one, cuz. Pray hard."
"Will you pray with me, Jamie?"
He glanced about the sept at the gods. The mother, full of mercy. The father, stern in judgment. The warrior, one hand upon his sword. The stranger in the shadows, his half-human face concealed beneath a hooded mantle. "I thought that I was the warrior and Circe was the maid. But all the time she was the stranger, hiding her true face from my gaze."
"Pray for me, if you like," he told his cousin. "I've forgotten all the words."
The sparrows were still fluttering about the steps when Jamie stepped back out into the night.
"Thank you," he told them. "I feel ever so much holier now."
He went and found Sir Ilyn and a pair of swords. The castle yard was full of eyes and ears. To escape them, they sought out Dari's Godswood. There were no sparrows there, only trees bare and brooding, their black branches scratching at the sky. A mat of dead leaves crunched beneath their feet.
"Do you see that window, sir?"
Jamie used a sword to point. "That was Raymond Dari's bedchamber, where King Robert slept on our return from Winterfell. Ned Stark's daughter had run off after her wolf savage Joff, you'll recall. My sister wanted the girl to lose a hand. The old penalty for striking one of the blood royal. Robert told her she was cruel and mad. They fought for 30 days. Well, Circe fought and Robert drank. Past midnight, the queen summoned me inside. The king was passed out snoring on the mirrorish carpet.
I asked my sister if she wanted me to carry him to bed. She told me I should carry her to bed and shrugged out of a robe. I took her on Raymond Darry's bed after stepping over Robert. If his grace had woken, I would have killed him there and then. He would not have been the first king to die upon my sword. But you know that story, don't you? He slashed at a tree branch, shearing it in half. As I was fucking her, Circe cried, "I want." I thought that she meant me, but it was the Stark girl that she wanted maimed or dead. The things I do for love. It was only by chance that Stark's own men found the girl before me. If I had come on her first. The pockmarks on Sir Ilan's face were black holes in the torchlight, as dark as Jaime's soul. He made that clacking sound. "He is laughing at me," realized Jaime Lannister. "For all I know, you fucked my sister too, you puck-faced bastard," he spat out. "Well, shut your bloody mouth and kill me if you can."